Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, December 22nd. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com is Gwen Friss. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner and Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. Now, a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands. We're going to start with a story that the Barnstable County Sheriff received approval this week to carry out federal immigration laws on a local level. It's a program called 287G. It's kind of complicated. Can you explain what's going on here, Gwen?
It is a little complicated, but perhaps the place to start is by mentioning that the sheriff is reassuring people that his authority with this program will be to simply research the names of people who are already being held, either with or without bail, at the Barnstable County Correctional Facilities. We're not talking about a program that goes into the communities for people who haven't been, charged with some kind of a crime. We're talking about people who are already incarcerated, maybe awaiting trial. You know, everybody who is physically in the what we would call the jail in the Barnstable County House of Corrections. So that's who the program applies to. And the Sheriff's Department here was one of several agencies that had applied for this designation. And what it allows them to do, it'll involve them sending, at least at the beginning, four of the Barnstable County employees to be trained by the Immigration Service. And it will also allow Barnstable County to have access to the ICE databases so they can see who they're dealing
with. And that's the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency,
right.
The U.S.
Yes.
Federal Immigration Agency.
Yes, it is. And you hear the term so often now that I think I skip straight to the to the acronym. It also, you know, it's a matter of access because the Barnstable County folks have already referred to the immigration, to the Federal Immigration Department. I think it's 15 inmates that they had discovered on their own were here in the country illegally. So it's not a question of whether they would do it. It's a question of them being more thorough now because they are supported by the federal immigration program.
Now, this does not come without some controversy and some people who have some concerns about this program.
There is controversy, and it's been expressed quite a bit lately. There was a meeting, I believe it was last week, where people were saying that the Cape Cod Coalition for Safe Communities issued a statement saying that they were expecting this outcome, but they think it's important for people to understand what it means. And at the same time, there are concerns. Some people are saying that this will make people more nervous about turning in people who, they might know are have committed crimes and that kind of thing, because it introduces another aspect for both the reporters and the people who are in the Barnstable House Correction. There's some concern that, say, if a family member visits or that kind of thing, that this could be open a door beyond that, so.
You can see where those concerns might lie. It sounds like both of the state senators from the region have kind of come aboard and said that they support the sheriff in this program. That would be Julian Sear and Vinny DiMacedo.
That's right. That's what we're reporting here.
And also, I thought it was curious in the article that it points out that Barnstable County joins Bristol and Plymouth counties as really the only ICE-approved law enforcement agencies in New England, along with the Massachusetts Department of Corrections. But really, just those three counties, which are our neighbor counties here.
Exactly. They're all clustered in this part of the state. So it is curious that it is, and I believe that Bristol was already in the first round.
And the state senator, Julian Sear, saying that he has support. He supports the sheriff and believes that he's spoken to him about the way this program is going to be executed and has confidence in the way that the sheriff intends to run it, as you say, from the corrections facility only, not bringing this into the community.
If you would like to learn more about this, the Barnstable County Sheriff James Cummings is scheduled to meet at the Barnstable Assembly of Delegates meeting on January 3rd.
Let's go now to a story about a body that was found in Plymouth this week. It turned out to be that of a Mashpee man who's been missing since the beginning of December.
Raymond Perry, he's a 64-year-old veteran, was reported missing in, actually, I think it was November 26th, and they have been looking for him. We didn't know when he was identified earlier this week. I believe it was on Tuesday. How it is that police found his body in Plymouth near the Carver Line. We don't know what led them to that area. But some things had been, well, let me start by saying that police say that Mr. Perry was a victim of homicide, dying from blunt force trauma and also cutting wounds on his neck. And he was, there had been several things going on before his body was discovered. They had visited the house, police had visited the house at least 10 times. And the house is on Riverside Road in Mashpee, where a waterfront home where Raymond Perry lived with his 37-year-old son, Eli Perry. And he has a history of arrests, including assault and drug charges. And in the meantime, after his father went missing, he was arrested on an unrelated charge during a traffic stop, and the police found the police report says that they found a gun in his truck. So one other thing we do know is that the police have obtained a search warrant for the Perry's home, and that they'll be executing that, and we should be learning more about what is happening there. And I just want to make sure that I make it clear that Eli Perry was arrested on an unrelated charge after that traffic stop. So, and in terms of Raymond Perry, his family says that he was an Air Force veteran, and he worked as a correctional officer until he was disabled, and he was a big motorcycle enthusiast. A little bit about Mr. Perry.
And he was last seen November 26th. He was reported missing December 1st, and excuse me, the state police are involved in the investigation, which really gives you a sense of the scale of there's a significant investigation here into what happened
and
with him.
I think that that is fairly common, too, when there are several locales involved.
Three offshore wind developers this week took a step closer to setting up turbines and starting to make electricity. This is wind power development going into federal waters south of Martha's Vineyard. Tell us about what happened here.
Well, the by April, these three companies, Vineyard Wind, Bay State Wind, and Revolution Wind, will hear whether their bids have been selected for negotiation to distribute wind-powered electricity to local distribution companies. See, the editor would have taken out that extra distribute. But when you're doing it live, you sometimes get those. So depending on the wind energy company that's chosen, construction of anywhere from 50 to 100 turbines will be completed in the federally leased submerged areas. And that construction could begin within 2 to 5 years.
And these the companies are actually setting up contracts to sell their energy now, I guess, is what's happening. They're making deals with energy companies.
That's one of the requirements for them to get the permitting that is needed from state and federal officials. So they have to do that and several other things. I don't know if you mentioned this when you introduced it, but these wind turbines would be located 15 to 25 miles off the coast.
And the companies, they're quite significant, the projects that they're looking at in terms of the power they can provide.
Yes, I was surprised at how much. A spokesman for Revolution Wind said that a couple of things. This would create jobs if it were built, and it would also provide power for about 200,000 homes, and that's for how much power they use in a year on average. That's what you could get from a 400 megawatt offshore wind turbine project. And I'm glad they explained that because, you know, the 400 megawatts wouldn't make too much sense without that context.
I think that it's the state is really pushing this not only for the environmental aspect of having offshore wind, but as you say, the jobs is a big piece of this and the number of jobs that it could potentially bring to the state. There's also the question of how they store energy, and it sounds like all of these companies have really had to come up with plans in order to be able to store the energy that they're generating for moments when the wind is not at peak capacity, because wind energy does not necessarily correspond with when people need it.
Absolutely. I imagine that as this progresses, we'll be taking even more of a look at the country's first offshore wind farm, and that's right next door, basically. It's off in the water, state waters off of Block Island, Rhode Island. And they have a 30 megawatt project over there. It's a lot smaller. So it's expected that the permitting and building will be a much bigger deal for this one that's proposed now, because it's 10 times, you know, more than 10 times bigger.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Frist. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup. On the Point, we're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Frist. And joining us on the phone right now is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, an FAA report, this is the Federal Aviation Administration, came out on skydiving safety at Chatham Airport. This has to do with a long-running controversy there. Explain for folks who haven't been following closely what's been happening here.
Sure. Skydive Cape Cod, a company that began operating at the Marston's Mills Airport, moved over to the Chatham Airport in 2011. Offering tandem jumping, which is where there's an instructor who is strapped to the sort of passenger, if you will. Now, the operation began to attract attention of neighbors in 2012 when one of Skydive's planes crashed into Lover's Lake near the airport after running out of fuel, and no one was hurt in that incident. But it highlighted for neighbors that and a couple other following incidents concerns about safety with skydiving. And neighbors began to complain more frequently, and momentum sort of built until 2013 when town manager Jill Goldsmith declined to renew Skydive Cape Cod's contract to operate out of the airport, pending what officials said they wanted a safety review of the activity from the FAA. Well, that finally happened this past fall after quite a number of other activities going on in the meantime. But just this week, the FAA issued that report, and they basically determined that skydiving at Chatham Airport was a low safety risk activity. They looked at 14 different risk factors, and they found 12 posed a low safety risk, 2 posed a medium risk, which they said could be ameliorated with some modest actions, basically some notifications going out to the aviation community on Cape Cod. But basically their conclusion was that skydiving at Chatham Airport is safe.
Now, the town is kind of squeezed between two different lawsuits on this. Is that right?
Now this goes back to that neighborhood group. They sort of coalesced into a group called Chatham Citizens for a Safe Chatham Airport. And they sued the town a couple of years ago, basically trying to stop the town from restoring skydiving at Chatham Airport. The FAA had ordered the town to allow the activity, which the federal agency said was allowed at general aviation airports, and the town had agreed to that when it accepted some $6 million in federal aviation grants over the years. And also this past year, Skydive Cape Cod filed a $100,000 breach of contract suit against the town. So yeah, you're right, Steve, that the town is, the FAA is saying it's safe. The town has one lawsuit from neighbors saying it's not safe, we don't want you to do this. And then they've got the Skydive company on the other hand saying, you broke our contract. We want $100,000, or we want to return to Chatham Airport. At this point, the town's attorney told us that what they're going to do, armed with this report, is go back to the attorneys for both these cases and see if they can reach a resolution.
Tim, also in Chatham, there's a plan in hand now for replacing the popular observation deck at the Fish Pier. Describe the observation deck for folks.
So if you go to the town's Fish Pier, which is on Aunt Lydia's Cove, it's where the commercial fleet of Chatham, which is the largest commercial fleet on the Cape, operates out of. The boats come in during the day and offload their catch, and there's an observation deck right above the fish offloading packing house. And some 3,000 people a day during the summer come in to watch the boats offload their catch. And also, it's a great place to see the seals without going all the way down to the end of Monomoy, because seals come in and try to basically beg for scraps off the fishing boat. So the deck had some structural problems in the past few years, to the point where the town's building department limited capacity to no more than 100 people at a time. And this week, the selectmen heard a plan to replace that deck with a larger, more solid structure that would accommodate more people. The estimated cost is $1.2 million, and one of the reasons that seems like a really high price tag for an observation deck is that there are accessibility issues. The deck will have to be accessible, and the terrain down there goes from a parking lot that's above the fish pier to a very low area below, where right on the water where the deck is located on the packing building. Officials, the staff looked at a couple different options for accessibility: a ramp with a bunch of switchbacks, a sky bridge from the upper parking lot. Those all proved more expensive ultimately than a special outdoor elevator that they've proposed to include in this project. At this point, selectmen endorsed the plan. They asked the staff to take it back to the engineers to refine it, get some bids. Now, they don't expect that to happen until the summer, so it's likely that the limitation will remain on that deck for the summer, and a new deck will be in place in about 2019.
But the deck that's there will be safe for the summer.
It will be safe, but again, it's limited to 100 people, and when you get 3,000 people a day trying to crowd down there, sometimes that makes for a pretty pretty crowded deck.
Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
With us is Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission said this week that Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station in Plymouth, which has a record of safety violations and poor performance, will be allowed to skip cybersecurity requirements.
That's true, and I wanted to mention that Christine Legere is the reporter, not only on this story, but she's the expert at the Cape Cod Times. So covering Pilgrim is very complicated. She spent a year looking at this plant and how it compared to others around the country. Mm-hmm. So if you need background beyond a particular story, we do keep that online at CapeCodTimes.com. That being said, this particular story, the plant in Plymouth has completed, I think, seven of the requirements for cyber security. But a really key one, the eighth one, is the one that they're being allowed to not complete until 2020, which is after their close date. So essentially, it's just not doing it.
The plant is scheduled to close in June 2019. Is that something like that? Or end of May 2019.
Right, end of May 2019. So that's a year and a half after the extension on their not having to do that last step in cybersecurity goes for a year and a half beyond that.
So understandably, advocates who watch the plant and are concerned about safety there feel like this is just one more thing to add to the list of things that concern them about the way the plant is operated if they don't have cybersecurity in place the way that the federal government has mandated it.
Yes, and you know, there's a lot of concern right now because of potential cyber attacks, being able to override systems and allow access to the plant and its safety measures. That would really be what the end concern is here: is that someone, because these cyber protections are not in place, someone, you know, could get in and sabotage the plant and spent fuel. So these are the sort of real life concerns about this not happening. It's not just a paper trail. And as you mentioned, one of the folks that we talked to, Mary Lampert, president of Pilgrim Watch, said, quote, "The whole thing is absurd." So it and this is also the third extension that Pilgrim has gotten on this particular issue. And this is why I had started by mentioning the stories that are in a trove online, because it does take time and attention to follow what's going on. This the plant's last extension, and I should say the plant, which is owned by Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, which is owned by Entergy, their last extension was expiring December 15th of this month.
And NRC is saying that they have sufficient compliance right now to get through to the end of their term until the middle of 2019, when they're scheduled to close. But it sounds like even the Congressman Keating is weighing in, saying he thinks that they should have been held to a higher level of compliance on the cybersecurity. Let's go over to a story on a new coalition that's aiming to do battle with alcohol problems on Cape Cod. There's a lot that's eye-opening, I think, in this story in terms of the impact of alcohol addiction.
There really is, and it starts with a not very proud standing that there was a study and it found that this was the Cape and several towns on the Cape are amongst the highest drinking towns in the state, and there are some numbers that Casey Myers has taken a look at, and I was surprised by this, but alcohol related deaths accounted for 71% of substance use fatalities, 135 out of 189 on Cape Cod in a single year, according to a 2015 study by Barnstable County Human Services. So people are drinking a lot, and it's taking a terrible toll.
And this new coalition that's coming together is aiming to attack the toll of alcohol addiction across the Cape, and it's kind of basing itself on a model perhaps that's happening in Iceland, the Icelandic model, they call it.
Pretty far away, but if it works, it works. What happened was a local investigator for the Alcohol, Beverage, and Control Commission is the one who's formed the Cape Cod Alcohol Coalition in the hopes of addressing problems caused by what he's calling the most deadly drug in the country. So Jamie Benenda. I apologize if that's wrong, sir. He has brought together people from different walks of life. There are some liquor store owners on the commission, as well as, I believe, a restaurant owner. And it's at this point, you know, it's not. They're not expecting people to, like liquor store clerks or owners, to become psychologists. But the reality is they do know who the repeat drinkers are. They know who's coming in at 9 in the morning to buy alcohol every day. So there's the hope that there might be some way for eventually for those folks to be able to offer some referral, you know, to try and get some help for people who are using alcohol more than most of us are.
One other statistic from this article, alcohol is involved in 75% to 80% of violent crime, such as assaults and domestic violence. That's according to the Massachusetts Alcohol Beverage Control Commission. So
The numbers surprise me, but the idea doesn't, because if you've ever worked a holiday in the newsroom, you know that that's often the case.
We're going to speak now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Hi, Steve. Good to be with you.
Ed, Herring Cove Beach parking lot has taken another blow from the weather. It was already in a pretty tough condition, right?
Yeah, this is a Groundhog Day story. This happens with alarming frequency. Another series of high wind storms last week caused a section of the north parking lot at Herring Cove Beach to collapse. And, of course, this is one of the most popular spots on the Outer Cape. It's one of the only places where you can really drive your car right up to the edge of the sea, and because the beach faces west, it's a spectacular spot for sunsets. But it's in an extremely vulnerable position in relation to erosion. And so this has been happening again and again. A section of the lot is now closed off, and there's still part of it that's open. But the National Park Service has been doing quick fixes for a number of years on it, spending $420,000 this past season for short-term repairs. And last year, the National Park Service paid $300,000 for a partial patch. But what really needs to happen is for the whole parking lot to be relocated, and there is a plan to do that. The Interior Department has approved $5.4 million for a design and engineering plan that will move the lot back 125 feet from its present waterside location and elevate it by 15 feet.
What kind of timing are they looking at on that?
Well, last I heard, they were talking about starting construction after this coming summer season. So if everything works sometime this fall, this coming fall of 2018, it will happen. Now, things tend to change with government funding. There had been a plan to do it before this coming year, and then something happened to the Jefferson Memorial in Washington. I think a piece of marble fell off, and that job jumped to the top of the list. But for a while now, the Herring Cove parking lot has been at or near the top of the Interior Department's list of important projects.
Ed, I want to ask you about another story you have. It's a nice story about a surprising bequest coming from a longtime Provincetown resident. Tell us about this.
Yes, Steve, this is a really nice story to have in our last issue before Christmas. Judy Polley was a longtime Provincetown resident who moved here with her husband, Eddie, back in 1970 from the Bronx, New York, and they fell in love with the town. Judy at first got a job working at the Veterans Memorial Elementary School, where she taught for more than 10 years. And meanwhile, Eddie opened several businesses in town, including the Hideaway Restaurant and then the Little Store and Blue Light on Commercial Street, which was a real Provincetown landmark. And the business was so good there that Judy eventually gave up her teaching job and went to work with her husband. They had no children, Eddie got sick and died in 2014, and Judy died unexpectedly in July of 2016. And it's just been revealed that in her will, she made three very large bequests to three local organizations, the Council on Aging, the Carrie Seaman Animal Shelter, and an organization called Helping Our Women, each received $155,000 from her. This was a total surprise, completely unexpected, said Chris Hoddle, who's the director of the Council on Aging here. And the money, she says, will be placed in a gift fund and used especially for delivery of services, including lunch and meal services and transportation for seniors. The money that goes to Helping Our Women, says Executive Director Elizabeth Gowron, will go to a special fund that is now named for Judith Polley to assist women with chronic illnesses or disabilities or life-threatening health conditions who are experiencing unexpected financial stresses. And of course, the animal shelter provides a no-kill animal shelter for adopting dogs and cats from the Outer Cape. And each of those groups is just really touched, and I think everyone in town recognizes that this was a great gesture. Judy's old friend and executor of her estate, Michael Rogofsky, says, "She's created a legacy of good in this town, and I'm hoping it spurs other people to think about these organizations and follow her footsteps."
It's a nice story about giving back to the community. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Andy Tomolonis at southcoasttoday.com. There's more in a moment. Welcome back to the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. And on the phone with us now is Andy Tomolonis of southcoasttoday.com. Andy, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Andy, a tragic story from earlier in the month continued this week as divers were able to get to a fishing boat that sunk off Nantucket and recover the bodies of two crew members.
Yes. Unfortunately, this is a somewhat familiar tragedy in New Bedford. I won't say it's common, but it's happened here before. Fishing boats go out late fall, early winter, and sometimes they're bringing home a haul that provides them with a Christmas bonus, and sometimes they don't come back. The weather conditions are unpredictable, and it's still a very, very dangerous profession. So this time it was the Misty Blue. It was a clam boat with four crewmen, and it went down on December 4th in the waters about 10 miles southeast of Nantucket. Two of the crew members, two of the fishermen, were recovered alive very quickly, and two were lost. So the search for the fishermen that were lost, Michael Roberts, 49, and Jonathan Sereva, 32, it was called off on December 5th. And for the families, that's a very grim time. I mean, when the boat goes down, it's grim. But once the Coast Guard calls off a search or changes it to a rescue effort instead of a recovery effort, you know, the community knows. The water is cold, and there's enough time passed by to realize that the crewmen are not likely to be coming back alive. So on Monday of this week, it was 2 weeks after the Misty Blue sank, state police divers recovered two of the bodies.
It took them 2 weeks to get there because of, what was it, the weather was preventing them from diving on it?
Yes, they wanted to do this, and they wanted to get help, you know, and get closure for the families, of course. But you don't want to cause another tragedy with divers going out in dangerous conditions. So the conditions weren't acceptable for diving, and so the team kept scheduling and then postponing, and then finally they found the bodies on Monday. So both families are grieving as they go into the holiday. And for us, you know, it's understandable that they don't want to talk to newspapers or TV cameras. So one family is speaking through a lawyer, and the other has commissioned their church pastor, the Reverend David Lima, to speak for them. Michael Roberts' survivors released this statement, and both of them thanked the Coast Guard. We'd like to commend the Coast Guard and Massachusetts State Police efforts, the Roberts family attorney, Mike Flynn, said. You know, they've been indefatigable in pursuing the retrieval of the bodies, and that's been so important to the family in this crucial time of grieving. The same goes for the other fisherman, Jonathan Sereva's family. They basically said the same thing. The Sereva family, as difficult as it is grateful both to the State Police diving team and the Coast Guard, and everyone involved in helping bring their son and Mr. Roberts home. And that was from Reverend David Lima.
So some closure, but not, it's a hard time going into the holidays for these.
Well, it certainly is. As I said before, it isn't common, but it is a recurring tragedy that happens in New Bedford. And we just marked the 40th anniversary of the Navigator sinking 3 weeks ago. It was a scalloper that went down, again, in the waters east of Nantucket. It went down on November 30th, 1977, and 13 crew members never returned. The weather was cold and snowy. There were winds nearing 40 knots, and there were 15-foot seas. So that's not the only one. On December 20th of 2004, just about a year after I started working here, the Northern Edge went down, and five men died in that tragedy. One crew member was rescued by another boat. And then more recently, on January 26th of 2007, the Lady Grace sank, and all four crew members were lost.
Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com. Andy, thanks for reminding us of these events and for updating us on the Misty Blue.
Thank you, Steve.
I'm Steve Junker. In the studios with us here in Woods Hole is Gwen Friss of the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, Woods Hole is bracing for a five-year construction project on an enormous scale as the Steamship Authority rebuilds its terminal. Word came out this week about the contract to build out the waterside.
That's right. It's the first phase of this six-year project, and that contract went to a Quincy construction firm with a low bid of $43 million. J. Cashman, Inc. will reconstruct the three ferry slips at the Woods Hole Terminal between now and May 2022. It seems like it's so far away, doesn't it? They'll be working on that, according to a summary of the December 5th meeting of the Steamship Authority Board. He was the that company was the low bidder on the project of seven bids, with the next lowest was $46 million, and the highest came in at $66 million. So
it does sound like it's a long way away when you say May 2022, but what that really means is that work is going to be going on during all that period, and steamship riders to the Vineyard are going to have to deal with that, as well as folks in Falmouth, in Woods Hole.
And you guys?
Us, right across from the terminal. People on the listening to the radio station will probably hear some of the residual noise bleeding through the microphones. But the waterside rebuild of this terminal, which is very big, they're going to rebuild three slips. The work is going to be going on mostly in the off season because they have to run the boats during the summer.
It is, and it's interesting that before the Quincy company can start their work, they have to take down the existing terminal building, has to be demolished, and the western portion of the wharf has to be excavated. So before Cashman will get started, there's another company, J.R. Vinegro Corp. of Johnston, Rhode Island, and they're going to be starting that demolition work in February. And my heart's going out to them. I guess they dress for it, but that's going to be a cold job. They'll do some work both before and after the project to start on slip three, according to the meeting summary.
So it's worth noting, too, $43 million for this contract, just the water side. There's a lot of work to be done in the new terminal and the parking area and the vehicle queuing area, that's all got to be reconstructed after the waterside is done in 2022. So it's a long and big project that riders and the community are facing.
I can say that there is a good side. You know, little kids often like to watch construction. I'm sure that as long as you stay out of the way and back away from it, there'll be a lot to see.
An increasingly noisy ocean means that fish may be having trouble finding each other to mate. That's according to a new study out.
And out of Woods Hole, the lead author of that study is working here. And they actually are not talking about construction, although those two stories were backed up next to each other. They're talking about ships and all the noise that's produced when ships are doing carrying goods, carrying people. There is concern, especially when you look at the cod population, that that the fish can simply not get across the message of, hey, they're good looking, I'm here, because that's a vocalization. It's an audio mating call, so to speak.
So they make cod and haddock make knocks and grunts, is what they're called. I didn't know this until I read the article, which are these sounds that they use to transmit their mating intentions and also spawning intentions. And the concern is that with all the white noise in the ocean from the ships going by, that they can't be heard much farther. They can't be heard as far as they used to be able to be heard when they're trying to communicate to each other.
This study, which was the lead author is Jenny Stanley, a postdoctoral scientist in the Passive Acoustic Research Group at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. I always have to stop and read that one. She's based at the center here in Woods Hole and works also on Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary. And what that study found is that as ocean sound increases, so does the concern for its effects on populations, because there's a correlation between what they're seeing in the specific species. If you look at the Gulf of Maine, cod are at a historic lows, with just 18% of the winter spawning stock remaining from what existed a decade ago, and only 23% of the spring spawners being there, according to the Massachusetts Division of Marine Fisheries.
Let's talk now about Falmouth, and a Falmouth official has issued an order for the town to come up with a plan to dismantle one of its controversial wind turbines.
The turbine has been dormant for more than 12 months, and according to bylaw on the books, that one of the neighbors is saying that means it has to come down. And there's concern about getting a plan in place, because for that turbine and the other one, which is also not being used, for them, it took a while to put up. It was very complicated. They need to take it down that way, too, if they want to be able to use it at any point. I don't know what the other possibilities might be. Sell it, whatever.
Well, the town is on the hook for quite a lot of money. They took out loans and to pay for these things, and they're built now, and they're on the hook for something like $10 million.
$10.5 million, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That amount includes the $4.62 million left in debt on the construction of Wind One, which I believe you were talking about there, and $2.9 million on for the loan on Wind Two. So it's a significant amount of money. It's like when you get upside down on your car loan, and they're not able to use those. So one of the neighbors, Mark Cool, a Fire Tower Road resident, has written a letter to the town saying that, you know, there's no question these have to come down since they're not in use and haven't been for over a year.
And at the same time, there are residents within Falmouth that are really pushing to try to think about how to not shut these down permanently, and pushing to intervene and even appealing a court decision in order to try to press the town to continue to run the turbines in some form.
Yes, they have the Green Center, along with some residents going under the name of Friends of Falmouth Wind, have now filed a notice that they will appeal a court ruling in Massachusetts Appeals Court.
We are going to talk now about a story out of Eastham, which is that an Eastham woman has been indicted of stealing quite a lot of money from a Provincetown resort where she was the manager. And her name is Donna Zoppi.
That's right. And she is charged with stealing more than $1.8 million from the now bankrupt resort and using that money to take expensive vacations, purchase a horse for her stepdaughter, club-level seats at Gillette Stadium, and attending the Westminster Kennel Club dog show in New York City, according to the legal records. She was the only one with access. This is according to officials who have charged her. She was the only one with access to the resort's fees that are paid each year to keep for maintenance and taxes and all the things that go into running a property. And she simply was not doing those things. You know, the
$1.8 million, a lot of money to be embezzling here. And it really is the thing that tipped this resort into bankruptcy, is what it sounds like.
That's right. And what ended up happening was the town bought that resort at auction for $8.1 million, and they are now working on creating low and middle income housing there.
And, Gwen, we have a story this week about a local teacher who took a top prize on a holiday cooking show. This is, if I can say, it is kind of a sweet story.
It is. I'm just pulling it out of my my pile of notes here. And Doug Alley, who is a teacher at culinary arts teacher at Upper Cape Cod Regional Technical School in Bourne, became involved in the process of a Food Network show in which over several months, it started last May, he went ahead and sent in photos of his work, and he put together a sugar cookie wreath that took the top prize, $10,000. The judges included Ree Drummond, who's known as for the Pioneer Woman cooking blog, and several others. And he said that even though it looks like it's very competitive, it was actually a fun experience. And his colleagues, his competitors, all took him out after he won.
Well, it's fun to have a teacher from the Upper Cape Regional Technical School make it right there to the top prize.
Actually, I'd like to add just one thing
to
that.
So I want to ask you a little. Yes.
Yeah.
What is
it? Are we talking about the same thing here?
Yes.
You know, if this prize-winning cookie maker, Doug Alley, were going to make cookies for Santa, you might expect that would be chocolate chip. But really, Santa prefers oatmeal raisin. Because if he gets full, the reindeer eat oats. And we found this out in
what kind of reporting goes on to find out this information?
We do it all, you know, work in that features department as well. And we were fortunate enough during his busy season that Santa stopped by our new Facebook Live studio at the paper. And he came on a show I have there, a half-hour show, called Life with Gwen. And if you didn't see it, it's very kid-friendly, this episode. You know, Santa is Santa, and that's it. And he talks about the flying reindeer, Mrs. Claus, all these things. And it's a half an hour that's fun to watch with the kids on our Facebook page at Cape Cod Times.
That's a very big celebrity get at this time of year, to be able to nab Santa for your show.
He's a man with a generous heart.
Tell us about, just briefly, you're doing a live Facebook show weekly. Explain for folks when they can see that and how that works.
Okay. Well, much to my embarrassment, it's called Life with Gwen, but I didn't name it. But it is a wonderful opportunity to meet people who are doing the kinds of things we write about. And during the holiday season, it's been a lot of fun. We talked about Hanukkah on the debut episode and then talked with Santa. Now, you can watch it live at noon every Wednesday. And if you miss it, you can go into the video section of our Facebook page at Cape Cod Times and then click on it anytime.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Gwen Friss, from the Cape Cod Times and CapeCodTimes.com. Thank you, Gwen.
Thank you very much, Steve. Nice to be here. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. Thanks to my other contributors. We heard from Andy Tomolonis, Ed Miller, and Tim Wood. Thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.